time, he felt that with both the primary tumour or a metastasis, clotting factors are given off by cancer cells, and then cancer cells tend to become coated with fibrin. He felt that our cancer cell-killing immunocytes can kill cancer cells more effectively if they can make contact with cancer cells. He felt that this fibrin coat on cancer cells acts as a protective barrier to prevent them from being killed by immune attack. I think that L. Michaels may have been one of O'Mara's students. In any event, Michaels had a report in The Lancet in the October 17, 1964 issue, pages 832-5, with the title Cancer Incidence and Mortality in Patients Having Anticoagulant Therapy. In that time frame, nearly every patient who had survived a heart attack or a thrombotic stroke was maintained for year after year on warfarin. The concept was that warfarin would prevent the formation of the red or fibrin thrombus. Michaels did a study of such patients to the extent of over 1,500 patient years. There was among them only one death, that of a primary lung cancer, when in this group 8 cancer deaths had been expected. Warfarin will tend to prevent the red or fibrin part of a blood clot. Dupridamol, by preventing the formation of the white or platelet thrombus, will also be preventing the formation of a fibrin thrombus, but without depleting vitamin K as warfarin does. The tendency of cancer cells to give off clotting factors puts cancer patients at a far greater risk of death from vascular thrombosis. They are greatly more at risk of death from a heart attack or stroke. In 1958, at the time of the first O'Mara report, there was very little thought being given to the role of platelets in heart attacks and thrombotic strokes. Beginning in 1945, the standard treatment for survivors of heart attacks or thrombotic strokes was to anticoagulate with warfarin or similar anticoagulating drugs. By 1970, the practice had almost completely come to an end. It was decided that anticoagulant treatment was not increasing survival. By then, it was understood that in the vascular tree, there will never be the formation of a red or fibrin thrombus without there first being a white or platelet thrombus. The discovery of the factors in the arachidonic acid cascade and of the platelet aggregation substance thromboxane, A2, was the basis for the Nobel Award for Medicine in 1982. It then followed that a platelet thrombus with no fibrin thrombus could be enough of an occlusion to cause a thrombotic stroke or a heart attack. With this understanding, along with the knowledge that aspirin will tend to reduce the aggregation of platelets, the entire medical establishment replaced warfarin with aspirin in treating heart attacks and thrombotic strokes. Since that time, there have been 3 trials in England in using aspirin in the prevention of a heart attack and 2 in the USA. Of these 5 trials, only 1, the Physician's Health Study in the USA, showed any benefit at all. This one trial that did show some benefit in the prevention of a heart attack used bufarin, and bufarin contains aspirin and magnesium. There are many reasons to believe that dupridamol at 300 milligrams a day will be far more effective in the prevention of heart attacks and strokes than aspirin. Moreover, dupridamol has none of the harmful side effects of aspirin. As of March 1999, there is now a new light thrown on the harm of platelet aggregation, this time with respect to cancer. In Cancer Research, March 1999, pages 1295-3000, B. Nieswand et al. Of the University of Regensburg, Germany, had a report on platelet aggregation and cancer. Using 3 different tumor cell lines in mice, it was demonstrated that tumor cells can activate platelet aggregation and that platelet aggregates deactivate cytotoxic NK cells, preventing NK cells from killing cancer cells. This is to suggest that dapridamol is a harmless drug. The generic form of it costs less than $1 a day for treatment. It has in one small trial been demonstrated that it is effective against melanoma. There is every reason to feel that it may be effective against a broad spectrum of cancers. If it were granted that all cancer patients are at a greater risk of heart attacks and strokes, it is hoped that many doctors will treat cancer patients with dapridamol for this reason. However, if they do so, it will soon be found that dapridamol will be having a marked anti-cancer effect. Wayne Martin, 25 Orchard Drive, Fairhope, Alabama, 36532, USA. Telephone 334-928-3975. Fax 334-928-0150. I felt like Alice in Wonderland again, staring at another bottle with a Drink Me label. This drug might be the lifeline I needed. From the letter, I gathered dapridamol would stop blood clots forming by breaking down fibrin, stop platelet aggregation, stop metastases forming, work in synergy with aspirin and magnesium, allow the immune system to remain intact and not be deactivated, allow natural killer cells access to circulating cancer cells, starve cancer of nucleosides for new cell DNA, e.g. adenosine and thymidine, and hold proteins in the circulation. It was this or further chemotherapy. No question I was going to take it, assuming I could get it prescribed. It was a no-brainer. But with all these anti-cancer effects, why was nobody using it? Surely it wasn't just because it was out of patent and cheap, so ignored, forgotten, and discarded. I knew enough about the workings of Big Pharma to know this was more than likely the reason. Wayne Martin wrote in another letter that the Boehringer Ingelheim sales rep used to speak of dapridamol's anti-cancer effects, but when their first patent ran out, they didn't mention it again. Eli Lilly repatented it for proliferative disorders like rheumatoid arthritis. Then Boehringer Ingelheim got the patent back again in 1998. All deeply suspicious behavior. Medical patents were not meant to be renewed like this. Once a patent expired, it was opened for other companies to produce cheaper generic versions. Why did they feel they had to protect this cheap drug at all costs? Who was Wayne Martin? A knowledgeable oncologist or complementary doctor? I discovered he was neither, and that he was 91 years old when he wrote this letter. He died 4 years later in 2006, sadly before I could shake his hand and thank him for saving my life. He was the most remarkable person, with an open, inquiring, and scientific mind, and a prolific contributor to the Townsend letter. Martin's first interest in medicine was kindled in 1926 at the age of 15. His mother, aged 40 at the time, was close to death, suffering from pernicious anemia for which there was no cure. A young Baptist minister had been attending to her daily, ready to give her the last rites, and one day he arrived announcing that everything was going to be all right. An article had appeared in his Baptist magazine citing research from Harvard where 46 late-stage patients with anemia had been cured by eating a pound of liver every day. The young Wayne Martin fed his mother liver 3 times a day, and sure enough, after 3 weeks, she was cured. But his doctor had scoffed at the reasoning. Ridiculous. Doctors do not learn medicine from the Baptist magazine. 10,000 patients a year continued to die of pernicious anemia until in 1938, 12 years later, the drugs firms launched a painful liver injection. It worked for some, but not all. It took until 1948 and the discovery of B12 to finally hail a cure for pernicious anemia. Eating a pound of B12-rich liver would indeed have worked. Martin came to realize early on that doctors in the US only paid attention if there was something they could sell, and only changed their practice when instructed to do so by the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors are encouraged to ignore studies, despite obvious truths staring them in the face. Randomized clinical trials paid for by the big pharma were the only acceptable data. Evidence from trials was the gold standard. Anything less ran the risk of legal action. After a motorbike accident in his teens, in which he lost a leg, Martin's chosen career in biochemistry switched to metallurgy. He was an inventor of many important patents of aluminium alloys. But he never lost his thirst for medical knowledge and continued to be an avid reader of medical literature, searching for a cure for both cancer and heart disease, his top priorities. He would digest facts, gather all the research together, and come up with theories, piecing the jigsaw together like a medical Sherlock Holmes, much like I was trying to do myself. Martin pulled together lots of studies on heart disease and cholesterol, and in the 1970s was the first to come up with the theory that HDL cholesterol was beneficial and protective, not harmful as many have since been led to believe. This was decades before Dr. Malcolm McKendrick and Kilmer McCulley slammed the industry for using cholesterol as a biomarker for cardiovascular disease. Rather than testing for cholesterol levels, Martin suggested that platelet adhesiveness was a far more important indicator of heart disease, as plasma fibrinogen has been definitively shown to be the biggest risk factor. The role of platelets has been continually ignored for both heart disease and cancer, yet these small forgotten structures have far more significance than most medics would have us believe. Martin felt anticoagulants were not effective enough to prevent heart disease. He was a passionate promoter of dipridamol for both prevention and treatment because of its effects on platelets. By the 1970s, two opposing views on cancer had already been firmly established: orthodox versus alternative. Martin's dismay at how big companies ruthlessly abused and used data for their own ends and quashed medical innovation led him to author Medical Heroes and Heretics in 1977. It is long out of print, but I managed to get hold of an old discarded copy from a library, which is now one of my most prized possessions. It is a wonderful account of the history of medical giants. He discusses Max Gerson, John Beard, William Kelly, William Coley, Ernst Krebs Jr., and Otto Warburg, who first noticed the abnormal cancer metabolism. All these names will be familiar to anyone researching complementary cancer treatments. He relates the agony of new medical discoveries that came with an almost inevitable rejection by the establishment. It was a subject dear to his heart. We learn of Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., who made physicians wash their hands; Louis Pasteur, who postulated the connection between disease and bacteria; Jonas Salk, who solved the mystery of polio. He charted the paths of many scientists over the centuries who have been ostracized, derided, vilified, and had their lives ruined, only to be proved right in the end. All braved the wrath and scorn of the medical establishment. At first heretics, ultimately they were all crowned heroes. And it seems little has changed since 1977. Medical discoveries suffer in much the same way today. It has taken 90 years for Warburg's theories on cancer metabolism to begin to step out of the shadows. And it is only the use of social media and the internet that is allowing